Welcome to the Daily Actor Interview Podcast. I'm Lance Carter, and in this episode, I'm talking with Britt Marling and director Zsolt Batmanglitch from the new film, The East. I got his name right. The East is a new thriller from writer-director Zsolt Batmanglitch and writer-actress Britt Marling. That has Britt working as an undercover agent at a private intelligence firm. She infiltrates a group called The East, who's been targeting companies that pollute the environment. But the longer that her character is with the group, the more she begins to sympathize with what they're doing. The film also stars Alexander Skarsgård, and it's a really good film. If you're looking for something that's going to make your brain work instead of mindless summer action, definitely check it out. I've talked to Britt three times now and Zsolt twice, and they are just so nice and normal people, very smart, and I love their films. So this was a roundtable interview, and you'll hear a bunch of voices, but you're going to enjoy it. We talk about the writing of the film and how they work together during that process, how Britt keeps acting notebooks for each project she's working on, and how they got the great cast for the film. I really do appreciate it when you support the advertisers, because that's how this website stays alive. Also, do you need a website? Every actor needs one, and Daily Actor is here to help. We do custom websites that are affordable, and it won't kill your bank account. We also sell casting director mailing labels and have a great actors resource page. Check that out, and also be sure to take a look at our other interviews on dailyactor.com. And now, here's Britt and Zsolt.
Let's say The East took 9 months to write. We didn't sit at the actual laptop with Final Draft open until 6 weeks before the end of that 9 months. Wow. So we don't write until the very, very end, the tippy end.
So what do you mean? Like, is it like you're just taking notes the entire time?
Well, we take notes, but we tell each other the story. So we think of it as more of like a storytelling process.
So it's verbal.
It's verbal.
Okay.
It's verbal, but it's also like you're looking to get the dance in your partner's eye. You know, like when their eyes sort of light up and they lean in, rather than like when they're glazed over and they're like, oh, what's for lunch?
Okay.
So do you have like a big board and like post like ideas everywhere?
It's all, I wish. Sometimes I go to other friends who are writers' houses and they have all these things and I think, oh, that looks so cool. It's like they do something so chic for a living. But no, we just tell each other the story.
You know, it's interesting that you say that because a number of years ago I did an interview with Paul Schrader asking about how he wrote Taxi Driver, and he had a similar process that he was basically saying you should just talk about it over and over again as if you're around a campfire, and then eventually you sit down once it's clear in your head. Is that kind of the process that you guys go through, that it has to be clear before you sit down to write?
Yeah, we should be able to sit here and either one of us tell you the story from start to finish for an hour and a half and have you guys in totally rapt attention. You know, if we can't do that, then it's never gonna be a movie someone's going to pay money to go see. I was just saying about our writing process that I always want to have like a big board with lots of like
the note cards.
But we never
do that.
We've tried, okay? Because I said it. I've seen it in different people's houses, and it looks so chic.
Or you see it in movies, and it looks so cool to like note card out your movie. But we never know how to do it. Maybe someone should teach.
But you're right. There's so much stuff that is nonverbal, and that's the beauty of movies, and that's why they're not novels. But the story part of it, you should be able to tell people. You know, and hold their attention, get their eyes to dance a couple times.
Yeah. So what do you guys learn from each other every time you take this journey of like sitting and putting a story together from scratch? Or at least with this?
I learn a lot. We learn a lot maybe about each other, you know, because I think it begins with like the ideas that you're interested in, things that are happening in your life, the observations you're making about your deepest, most personal relationships. I think a lot of like writing together comes out of trusting each other enough to talk about your deepest fears and your great confusions, and from that space, like slowly, the winds and the temperature and the pressure and the humidity starts to swirl around the eye of some storm that you're interested in. I learned something good, which was that the straitjacket scene had been about a parable Zal had told me once that had really moved me, like, years ago. And the parable was about heaven and hell, and how heaven and hell is the same banquet table with the same food, the same feast, and everybody is chained up in both heaven and hell. But in heaven, the people feed each other with the spoons, and in hell, they're just going for it themselves and they can't get to the food. And that parable really left an impression on me. We went to write a scene later about Benji, and I was like, oh, the parable. Benji says the parable, blah, 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 blah. You write out all this dialogue. And we came back to it, and Zal was like, it's the right feeling, but it doesn't work. It's not cinematic. How do we make this a cinema scene and not a novel? And then we cracked the thing of actually making the parable a real moment, of putting people in the straitjackets and having the soup in front of them and having that be a moment that we show rather than tell. That was something he taught me.
Do you guys ever have a situation where you're just really arguing about a specific scene and one of you has to give, and then when you see it, you're going, I think my way, or would you film it two different ways, that certain scene, and really gauge it that way?
We've only argued about something once in two movies we've made, and that was never in the writing phase.
Oh, okay.
Now,
breakfast or lunch?
Yeah, well, no, it's like something on the east. But it's funny. The writing part of it, it's so clear when it works and where it doesn't. The moment you have to argue your point,
it's not working.
Like,
see, that's weird that you say that, because, like I told you last night, for an hour after Sound of My Voice, me and these critics stood around arguing, and we all loved it, but we were arguing interpretations. And I guess for that, it's a different thing than when you're actually writing it. But I would think when you're writing it, you would want to say, you can't do that, you're giving them too much. And I could see you guys just butting heads, so it's weird that you, that doesn't
happen.
Yeah,
it's weird, because we do that in real life all the time. Like, you know, in our six-day writing week, we spend three of those days just doing housekeeping, you know,
right.
Like, and we argue plenty in that.
Yeah.
Like,
but I guess it's because a good story is a good story. There's some sort of democracy to it. Like, everybody leans in, usually, when it's a great story. That's why the ones that are truly great are touchstones for everyone. We can all know them and tell them to each other. So if in the writer's room it works, then nobody needs to argue about it. And then those things sort of stay in.
Yeah, I don't think we've ever argued about a story point or anything.
Do you find that you have any rituals?
I make a new notebook for everything.
That's true.
And I have some sort of fixation with that, where I buy a notebook and I buy, like, decoupaging glue, or like, and I rip things out of magazines and images and I paste it all together, and I have to kind of like start the notebook as a way of organizing everything that comes inside. And there's some process of that like relies on deciding on an image or something to begin it with.
Does that help you for acting wise as well?
Yeah, I also have acting notebooks.
She then makes a notebook for the acting. Yeah, those are beautiful. And sometimes I'm like, oh, those are really beautiful.
I've taken to throwing those away, though, because they can kind of become a crutch, where, like, you bring that book to set and you keep, like, looking at it as if it's going to save your life, you know, and you really need to just light that book on fire and let go. So
you start it, and then right this the day you start filming, you throw it away?
Yeah,
yeah.
That's my new trick.
Oh, cool.
I literally put it in the garbage can.
Is it more fun for your parents now that you're doing these movies like Arbitrage, where, like, as great as Another Earth is, and our Film Critics Society voted you Best Actress that year.
I know,
but as great as that movie is, it's got to be more fun for your parents to go, there's my daughter in a scene with Richard Gere.
They totally like that. I mean, they think they loved Another Earth, and they were excited by, you know, what happened that year at Sundance and stuff.
But oh, okay.
I think also they, you know, parents worry about their kids, and they wonder if they're, like, ever going to be able to, you know, they're going to be able to live their lives and, like, support themselves and be happy. So, for whatever reason, they think that, you know, if you're screaming at Richard Gere in Central Park, that that's somehow closer to stability, which I'm not sure, honestly, if that's the case.
Yeah. Does the notebook stretch back to your studio art days?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think probably.
But how so?
I was doing econ and studio art in school, and I think maybe something about the painting and the, I don't know, something about that, I think there's sort of a brainwave space you get into when you're making a piece of art, which is you sort of stop thinking and you're just feeling your way through it. And maybe there's something about setting off on the beginning of a new character or endeavor, that you kind of got to get into it by not looking at it directly, you know? And I think making something lets you do that, or reminds you that it's a creative endeavor, that you can't open the script and think about it like it's a math proof that you're just going to work your way through, you know? It's something more, I don't know, like closer to meditation than to like a rigorous problem that you could solve, maybe.
When you're writing a character, do you know from the beginning that you're going to be playing that role? Or is that something that happens along the way, and does that, do you think that changes how the character's written?
No, I mean, we know that Britt's going to play, like, we knew Britt was going to play Sarah. We wouldn't waste our time if we didn't know who she was going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's part of it.
Yeah, it's, I think, yeah. I think, but it's also part of it, too, is maybe about, like, trying to think of something that we haven't seen in a female role before. Like, Maggie was so much fun because we got to ask ourselves the question of what does a female cult leader look like? And I haven't really seen that. I don't know what that is. Like, and we would talk about it. Well, is she, like, how does she get lure people in? Is it because she's, like, an ingenue and sort of innocent and people tumble into her Venus trap, you know? Or is it because she's sort of intense and domineering? Like, how does a woman hold a group's attention? That was a real puzzle for us to figure out. So
it seems like you do that with all of your, because all of your female characters that you guys write together are so strong, and it's not something that you see in a lot of film. I try and see everything, and it's very rare to see a female character where you can actually see that person in real life as somebody that could exist and not a cliche and not, you know, a combination of practice in Hollywood film.
You even wore your hair like Sarah today.
I love your hair.
Thank you.
As soon as I sat down, I was like,
I noticed one of the scenes in the movie. I was like, I really like how she rolled her hair.
Yeah.
You were on, like, the train.
Yeah, we worried later that maybe we were going too far with that hairstyle, but I liked it. I thought it was cool that she did something feminine.
Yeah.
You know?
It was interesting, too, that she did that.
Yeah.
Like, as if she had known that they were going to be going somewhere that wasn't exactly dirty. I mean, she never would have had that hair earlier in the film.
In the East. No,
yeah. She never would have had it in the East House.
Yeah.
No, but he told her to dress up in a suit. Like, she knew that they were going somewhere corporate. She just didn't dream that it was her own workplace.
Yeah.
It works really well, too, that Skarsgård, like, looks like Charles Manson in one scene, and all of a sudden you're like, oh, he cleans up pretty well.
Surprise.
Yeah, we like the idea of those transformations and of the like, play of identity and how much you feel you know about somebody based on what they're wearing and whether they've shaven or not shaven and how they're doing their hair. I mean, it's crazy that we're taking so much... We make so many predictions about who that person is based on, like, their presentation. So.
Well, you know, I'm curious as to your guys' take on this, because one of the complaints I get from my friends when I review a movie is they say, my big beef is, I say, well, that character wouldn't have done that. And I think the characters are given a logic by the writers, and if they're doing something different. And one instance in this, well, there were two in your movie. One, I didn't see Ellen Page changing as much as she did when her dad's in the water. I think her dad needed a few more lines to really express remorse, and then I would have just been... And I'm not saying I disliked the scene. It was a great scene still. But it just seemed like it was too quick if he just says sorry, and then all of a sudden she's, you know... So I think the scene still works, but I just would have liked... And the same with you.
I don't think you're wrong. I think that, you know, we shot that scene in one night, the entire scene. A normal movie would have had a week to shoot that.
Yeah. Just, so you can't contemplate every aspect.
No. It's, you just can't get the coverage. The contemplation was right. We would have loved it, but Jamie Sheridan, that water was freezing cold, you know? You only have so many takes, and we had two takes of him, and then... you know, I just didn't get all the... It's just a couple beats. What you're saying is you needed an extra couplet in there.
Well,
I don't disagree.
And also, the other scene that I'm thinking of is when you're with Patricia Clarkson and you grab that apple. Like, it's so great because we're like, wow, you're so into their... You know, it's perfect. But I wish she would have said something just a little bit snarkier to just make you unravel like that. Like, it seemed like your character was smart enough that you still would have, like, I got to get out of this office... And then
let us give you a little insight into that scene, so you can tell the other film critics. That's a sister scene to when she leaves the soup scene and she goes out into the woods, and she's like threatening Benji, and she's like, "Oh, how come resistance movements are always so hand in hand with self-righteousness?" She's actually countering Patty Clarkson so that Patty doesn't suspect her as being a double agent. the idea is that only true believers can counter. Does that make sense?
That dissent is a way of proving your
loyalty.
Allegiance.
Yeah.
That like that a fake and a phony never dissents.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Just goes along. Okay.
If you're trying to infiltrate the anarchist world and all you do is espouse anarchist philosophy, the anarchists are going to be like, meh, come on, like probably a fraud.
Yeah, because no anarchist is like that.
But if you infiltrate the anarchist group and you turn to the lead, one of the anarchists, charismatic anarchists, and you're like, gosh, why is it that these resistance movements are always tied hand in hand with self-righteousness?
Whoa,
then suddenly the person's like, well, maybe she isn't undercover. Like, maybe this is a real person. So we were trying to pull the same jam on Patty Clarkson there, but you're right, we may not have gotten her to believe.
With the, you guys got a really, really, really good cast.
Thank you.
Did you know sort of beforehand of like, oh, you know, Alexander Skarsgård might be good for this, or you know, or anything like that?
Any of the people we imagined in the roles, none of them turned out to be in the movie.
Yeah.
And now, today, I mean, Izzy is Ellen Page. I can't imagine.
Yeah, I can't imagine anybody else in any of the roles. You know, Charlotte Fernandez was great, you know.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
Toby Kebbell
as the doc.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was amazing.
He was Johnny Quid in that rock and roll, and it's
exactly.
Like, wow, it's so different.
He's an amazing actor. Yeah. I mean, he's an amazing actor.
And that, you know, that was a great directing move too, where you had him tell the story about his sister, and you don't have him go over the top crying, but he's choking up just enough to where we're just totally going, oh my, it was brilliant.
Yeah. Yeah.
Direct,
yeah.
You know,
how did you guys approach the moral ambiguity of the film? Because I really didn't expect halfway through the film to really start feeling bad for these corporations, people behind them, because it was almost childlike. I mean, I know that intellectually they realized what was behind what they were doing, the actions on the world, but it was almost childlike of showing a child the implications of his actions and then finally having that moment of realization of like, oh wow, if I burn the ants, they're going to die. Shocker. So I thought it was really, really neat how you really organically showed the change within them and actually felt for them. How did you manage that?
Well, I think that we were like... We felt so frustrated, you know, the pharmaceutical is based on a real pharmaceutical, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it really, some people take it and they end up in wheelchairs from this. You know, young triathletes, young mothers take a couple pills of this commonly prescribed antibiotic and have their lives devastated.
Mm-hmm.
And we just want someone to be held accountable for that. Like, but then once you act out the fantasy of creating your own eye for an eye, eco-activist group that does hold them accountable, you start feeling bad for
them. Yeah, there's still implications.
You start feeling bad for the person who's being, the kid who's being taught the lesson, you know? So, naturally it flips.
Yeah. Yeah, I think because, too, like, even the person running the corporate, the person running the corporation is still a person and it's probably a deeply feeling person, and a large part of what's so strange about the structure of things is just the remove.
Mm-hmm.
I think anyone who's confronted with a 4-year-old boy who's been taking in so much arsenic through his bathwater that he's developing tumors in his brain is going to crumble at the sight of that, and it is going to be somehow changed. But things are designed to keep those people mm-hmm. apart. And so there is something interesting about creating situations in which they have to come together. And then, of course, how could you not be impacted if someone said, oh, these are the results of your actions, and mm-hmm. maybe you've been keeping them. And what does Izzy say at one point? Says, she's like, we didn't know. And Izzy's like, you did know.
It was just easier to pretend that you didn't.
Yeah, I really loved that entire scene. I actually thought the length of it was actually perfect, because, I mean, there's definitely points with wanting maybe a little bit more from the father, but in the end, like, that's her dad, I think. In a split moment, she was going to change. And maybe after that scene, if she had lived, that she would have gone back a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think in that scene, you can't. I mean, it's your father in arsenic water.
And he's
and
naked.
It's right on remorse.
Yeah.
I think anybody in that situation would be like, holy shit,
what did I just do?
She's convinced me.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, she didn't want her dad to go in. She wanted the other chick to go in.
I think that you brought up a really good point, though. I'm grateful to you for having brought it up, which is the idea of, like, I don't think we made a movie to show anarchists as good guys or anarchists mm-hmm. as bad guys, and to show corporations as good guys or bad guys. We made a movie to show the system is broken.
Yeah,
and that's
society.
The problem. Like, as you even try to hold people accountable to show exactly, you know, to make them go through exactly what they made other people go through, it doesn't even work. So you know that there is no justice. Like,
mm-hmm.
if justice is literally doing that, right? Like, you kill my family, you're gonna get killed. Like, that is justice, right? And there is no justice anymore in our world. And I think that shows that our system is really broken. And I think that's what we were interested in exploring.
Thanks, guys, and thank you for listening. Keep coming back to Daily Actor for more great interviews, news from film, TV, and theater, and so much more. Follow me on Twitter at Daily Actor, and like our Facebook page, facebook.com/Daily Actor. Thanks for supporting the advertisers. I'm Lance, and I'll talk to you soon.